evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, it's my recent conversation with Jim Peterick. He founded both the band The Ides of March as well as Survivor, and with the latter, gave us Eye of the Tiger. He co-wrote Heavy Metal with Sammy Hagar, along with any of the biggest hits from 38 Special. He's also just released a single reflecting on audiences these days due to the coronavirus pandemic, or maybe we should say the lack of audience. It's called Empty Arena. That's less than 20 minutes away. First, though, a sci-fi classic re-released. Emmanuel Rogers has more.
Joining us now is publisher and president of Galaxy Press, John Goodwin. John, thank you for joining us today. Before we get on to talking about what we're here for, the re-release of Battlefield Earth, the book, will you share with our audience a little bit about who you are?
Sure. So as the president and publisher of Galaxy Press, I have what I consider the distinct honor to be responsible for republishing all the fiction works of L. Ron Hubbard. It's the same author that wrote Dianetics and later than that, Scientology. But prior to that, he was one of America's most popular writers of genre fiction, writing adventure, mystery, westerns, science fiction, and fantasy. In fact, he was one of the authors brought in by then the publisher called Street & Smith to help create this magazine called Astounding Science Fiction under the editorship of John W. Campbell. And so what they were writing back then in the late 40s is what became now known as the Golden Age of Science Fiction.
Right.
So he took the people aspect of his adventure stories and put that into the science fiction to take it from being just the ray guns, blasters, and spaceships into actual people of it. So I'm able to republish all of his works, and now we're republishing Battlefield Earth, but it's been a true delight. And also, just as one other point, too, is after he wrote Battlefield Earth and saw it published in 1982, in 1983, he created a contest called Writers of the Future, and that's now seen as 32nd volume published, and many of the top writers of science fiction and fantasy actually got their start in this contest after, you know, 32 years. And because of the contest's success, 5 years after its inception, the Illustrators of the Future, the sister contest, was implemented, and likewise, you see a lot of today's successful practitioners of illustration, sequential art, graphic designs for movie sets got their start and their recognition from the Illustrators of the Future contest.
Okay. Now, John, you are a publisher and you are the president of Galaxy Press. Today we are talking about a classic science fiction novel, Battlefield Earth. Before we talk some more about that, what are some of your favorite science fiction titles?
It's interesting. I really fell in love with science fiction reading E. Doc Smith's The Lensman series. I read them, and I read them again, and I read them a third time. That whole thing of it started off just here on planet Earth, and it was like, you know, limping along, trying to advance, and then some of it getting beaten down, trying to advance, and then they make it, and then it goes from just being planetary to interplanetary to interdimensional. It was just, I just totally devoured it, and that concept of these people, the Lensmen, who were ethical, were able to do the right thing. But even when the guys that, you know, the bad Lensmen that were fabricated by Bosconians, you know, if you've read this story, you know what I'm talking about. If not, I'm talking gibberish.
I know. And I'm just looking. I'm just wondering what my audience is thinking. Bosconians. Is that from Bosconia? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the Eresians are the good guys. The Bosconians are the bad guys. And anyway, just how it ended up in ultimately, as in Battlefield Earth, the thing that wins in the end is the human spirit. You know, it's right. that spirit of man to overcome all obstacles is what ultimately prevails. That's what I really liked about the Battlefield Earth. But with, I guess that's the book that just really got me hooked. I've read, you know, various Heinlein. I've read a lot of the major authors, and I've obviously with Writers of the Future,
right.
I read a dozen new writers every year.
Okay.
Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game, and then Ender's Shadow, and that whole series, I enjoyed that. Tim Powers, all of our judges in the contest, I've read all their books. You know, I've read books from all of them, I should say. The main thing I enjoy about science fiction, though, is, as Mr. Hubbard says also in Introduction to Battlefield Earth, it's the herald of possibility. You know, it puts you into thinking, like, wow, how could that be? And what would life be like with, you know, being a fact rather than just an imagination type thing? So I know the whole thing of you got two lines of approach with science fiction. You've got the utopian and dystopian. And sometimes dystopian, like with Mary Shelley, shows how science is harmful to mankind. You've also got what, you know, the actual outcome of science could be very, very good and helpful for mankind, which is Robert Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and a lot of those authors of that period of the Golden Age were actually writing. And that's something I really find pleasure about. And the standing jokes of some people, you know, that what's the Golden Age of science fiction? They say 13. I've long since passed that Golden Age of 13, but I still enjoy science fiction and that right. sense of wonder that it creates for me.
Yeah, and it's a great escape for those who just want to read about things that are possibilities, but mm-hmm. things that we really haven't seen or probably won't see in our time.
Right, but it's amazing how much things have come to pass over the last, like, 50 years that people are seeing stuff, you know, on Star Trek. I mean, some of those things, Beam Me Up, Scotty, that transponder that he uses, everybody's got that right now with their cell phones. Mr. Hubbard also talked about, at the same time, having devices, electronic devices that you can read not just one, but you can read multiple books on. You know, that's now we got the Kindles. So science fiction writers have always talked about stuff as this is what could be, you know, even go back to the H.G. Wells with a yes. submarine and, you know, how we're going to get man on the moon. All that type of stuff was originally thought up by science fiction writers or
right.
people who wrote into that type of a storyline. And in the 30s and 40s, when L. Ron Hubbard was writing, a lot of their day jobs were the rocket scientists. These are the guys that were conceiving of the rocketry and that type of stuff, and their nighttime job was writing the stories.
Right.
So it's a very much a close relationship.
Well, it is a close relationship, but they didn't get to see these things in their time, and I think that's what I was just trying to bring about.
Sure.
Because as someone writes a science fiction today, and they bring up things that have to do with traveling through black holes or, you know, going and doing time travel while going through a black hole. We haven't realized such things yet.
Correct.
But, you know,
you're absolutely right.
With War of the Worlds, there are a lot of things that were brought up in movies like that. War of the Worlds, Forbidden Planet,
mm-hmm.
just space travel itself. Scanners and being able to scan things and find out information from a distance without having to break things open. We've gotten there, but the guys that wrote it haven't gotten to see it.
Good point. Yeah, Gene Roddenberry never saw his transponder actually come into life.
Yeah, and I don't think he's ever saw a Vulcan and awake anyway.
you're absolutely 1,000% correct on that.
But now, the premise of Battlefield Earth has to do with a scientific conversation between two scientists that we know of, Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Carl Sagan was one of the gentlemen who helped put the gold disc on the Voyager project and helped to come up with what information would be on it. So,
including the directions to this planet in a galactic star chart. You know, he did it with this whole premise of we're going to go out there and reach out to, if other life exists, we want to let them know who we are and where we are and all about us. You know, when 1977, when the Titan 1 rocket launched Voyager 1 into space.
So now what we have is a race of aliens known as the Cyclos
mm-hmm.
who find this disc, and then what do they decide to do with the information?
Well, basically, because it's on gold, which per the storyline is one of the rarest metals, most valuable metals in the galaxy, they decide they're going to trace back that Voyager probe, then basically send in their gas drones and they wipe out virtually the entirety of the planet and begin mining for all the minerals. You know, you got the gold, but you also have other minerals that are mining and sending back to their home planet in other, there are 16 different universes, not just the galaxy, but the universes,
wow.
and they've got control of many of those, of the habitable planets then. So they start mining it for all of its resources. And so Earth has been dominated by these Cyclos for 1,000 years. And like the opening line, from the main bad guy, Turl there, man is an endangered species.
So fortunately, the Cyclos have this hubris going on where men are so beneath them than monkeys are to us.
Yeah.
And so they think no matter what they do, they can get away with this. So how does mankind come back with this? Because even our spoken language was gibberish to them, and they didn't care much that we spoke to one another at some points.
Yeah, so the way it actually works, and this is one of the things I find fascinating because I've done so much over the years working with literacy projects, is that the guy that turns out to be the hero, Johnny Goodboy Tyler, begins his recovery of taking back the planet in a library. He makes
right.
it into a library and learns about books, learns how to read, and because of the Cyclos, this bad guy, he's got his own personal greed that's very much inbred into him. He wants to be able to use this man thing to be able to help him mine so he can get the gold for himself. So he starts training him. So Johnny starts learning, and through education is how he's able to overcome oppression and suppression. And that's very much applicable to what we have right now. Anytime it is a person's solution to overcome oppression in his own life is through education. He can learn. He can learn how to deal with it and handle and thereby overcome it.
Now, the wonderful thing about this story is it was made into a movie, and I told you I'd bring this up.
Mm-hmm.
But unlike the book, the movie was very different. It was very different in that, okay, well, first we have John Travolta and Forest Whitaker as stars, and the movie was a little campy.
Right.
What I am wondering about with the book and the re-release of it, is there anything different about this re-release for the book, and are you thinking about remaking the movie?
That's a very good question. So with the re-release of the book, there is a difference to it. The book itself is the same story.
Okay.
We've added on 50 pages at the end of the book, which during the time of his writing of the book, he had about 700 pages of handwritten notes.
Wow.
Of different scenes and scenarios and how different races related to other races. And so we've put in about 11 of those handwritten notes in the back of the book. He also did an interview with the Rocky Mountain News in 1983.
Okay.
That goes on for about 20 pages. It was 7 full pages in the newspaper then. And this answers a lot of questions about the story, what it's about. Does this mean you think that we're going to be invaded by aliens? He answers that question. But he also asks, what's the message of this book? And this part here I think is super way cool. And it's, he said that, okay, this is something that might happen. We might be attacked by aliens. But in the end, ultimately, it will be the human spirit that survives. And that's our secret weapon, is our own human spirit, that will to survive. And so the education, the literacy, all those things help enhance that. So that's been added to the book as well. Plus, we have a 47.5-hour audiobook that we created. It's unabridged, 67 actors, over 150,000 sound effects, 3 hours of original music created. That in itself is total immersive sound, and we call it like high-definition audio. We're now in a position to renegotiate movie rights, game rights. We are halfway through putting together a graphic novel, about 20 comics turning into a couple graphic novels. So we see a very bright future for this book based on the successful re-release of this edition.
Okay, now with that being said, before I ask you how our audience can find more information about this, let me ask you one quick question about the graphic novel. Now, in the movie and the book, the aliens looked different. If you read the book, you had a different picture of how the aliens look than what we saw in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
In the graphic novel, will we see Forest Whitaker and John Travolta wearing those boots they wore in the movie?
No.
Thank you. Okay. Now, with that being said, will you share with our audience how they can find more information about the re-release of Battlefield Earth and where they can go to find information of other science fiction works?
Sure. Well, we have our main website, which is galaxypress.com, like galaxy, like stars in the sky.
Gotcha.
Press is an imprinting press, so galaxypress.com. And amazon.com, barnesandnoble.com, in almost all the Barnes & Noble stores across the United States. Other thing you can do, too, is we've got a Facebook page, which pretty much stays updated 3-4 times a day with all the stuff that's happening, and that's Battlefield Earth.
Right.
We have a Twitter feed, which is BE_the_book. And one thing I didn't mention, too, which I want to say is, if you like science fiction, Battlefield Earth, on a survey that was done a few years ago by Random House on the Modern Library Readers Poll, came at number 3 of the top 100 fiction books of the 20th century. It was the top science fiction book. It was the number 3 of all fiction books of the 20th century. So if you like epic science fiction, that's what this one is, and it's totally that type of a story that man has been totally all but decimated.
Yes.
And like I said, the opening line, man's an endangered species, and by the end, it's a whole saga of how he's going to take back the planet. So there's a reason why over 4 million copies have been sold and why it was voted number 3 of the top fiction stories of the 20th century. And so if you like good science fiction, in fact, this is the first book to hit the New York Times when it released in 1982 in about 15, 20 years. It was the first science fiction New York Times bestseller. So it was quite an amazing tour de force and remains so.
And, you know, with that, I really like to encourage our listeners that love science fiction to check out the book. I'm not endorsing the movie, though I myself watched it 4 times and probably will watch it again because I make a study of things and like to laugh at some stuff. But thank you for the re-release and giving a fresh perspective on this, because there are so many who know about the movie who don't know that the book was very well written.
Exactly. Yeah.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with John Goodwin with Galaxy Press. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Let's go now to my recent conversation with Jim Peterick, founder of the Ides of March, survivor, and co-author of quite a few mega hits for a few bands. We'll hear about all that after a bit, but first, his very recent release called Empty Arena, a song which rather poignantly speaks about the coronavirus pandemic and how it's affecting so many of us. It's also a song of hope.
What if the team's got a touchdown and nobody cheered? What if the band played their big encore with no one in his shot to hear? What if the children learned all of their lies, determined to sing at their moment to shine? But mom and dad were nowhere standing near. This is the sound of one hand clapping in this empty arena. We used to join hands.
When I got this email, it was indicated this would be out in a few days. It would be released for purchase and streaming in the coming days. Is it out yet, or is it still just about to be out?
It is officially out 5 days ago. It hit all the various conduits, iTunes, of course, which is a big one, and Spotify, which is really coming on, also Apple Music and Amazon Music. So very easy to download, and you know the proceeds are going to Music Cares, which is just a great organization that the Grammy Foundation set up many years ago for struggling musicians. And of course now in this day of the pandemic, all these gigging musicians are out of work, and not everyone is fortunate to have a royalty stream or a bank account that will float them. So it's really quite a situation.
Yes, I can't think of the last time I even had to think about something like this. It would probably be some of the musicians' funds created around the time of Katrina, perhaps.
Right.
Well, so Empty Arena itself, the song, I'd really love to hear about the very inception of this song. As far as if maybe you started to see a lessening in audience members in performance venues, and then, of course, we got to the point of none at all, or is this maybe the notion of what so many are going through? How did this come together, the first moments that made you pull over right away and write it down?
Wow, great, great question. I always like to go to the inception of a song. You know, I remember where I was in practically every song I've ever written, especially the ones that, you know, made an impact. Like, you know, I remember everything about the inception of Eye of the Tiger and Vehicle. But this one really started about 3 weeks ago. And I was watching TV with not a whole lot to do at that moment, like most of us. And the Black Crowes came on. And I really loved that band. I hadn't seen them in years. And they were doing a reunion concert for an empty theater. And they were giving their all. You know, like the true pros that they are, happy to be playing and getting their music out however we can. That's the thing with musicians that are committed to their career and to their audience. However it gets to the people, that's what we do. And I was so inspired by that. I wasn't in the car. I went to my piano, and I just got inspired by that notion. I'm kind of watching TV, and to the side of me, I see this football team, a professional football team, playing their game to an empty stadium. And that was really dramatic. I mean, as dramatic as the Black Crowes were, seeing this team giving their all. And I wrote down the line, what if the team scored a touchdown and nobody cheered?
Yeah.
What if the band played their big encore with no one to hear? And then I wrote down, this is the sound of one hand clapping.
Yes.
In the empty arena. And that was chilling. I got a goosebump when I wrote down that line. And then the music, as it does, I kind of channel something. I don't know if it's the greater spirit or what, but I closed my eyes and I wrote this melody, which really, really sounded good. And I finished the song in about, 6 hours of just nonstop trial and error, like most of us do. And 2 days later, I was in the studio. My son has a studio called the Jam Lab, and I called together a few musicians. This was before there was a total quarantine, and musicians were getting together, and we were, you know, keeping 6 feet apart and bumping elbows instead of shaking hands, And we recorded Empty Arena, and I did the vocal in 2 takes, because, I mean, when it's inspiring, the vocal just happens.
Sure.
And it's made an impact. And so far, we've raised $5,000 for Music Cares through donations that we solicited. I did a live stream show 2 weeks ago from that same studio with just my son as host, Kellen Peterick, and me, one cameraman, and we streamed to 62,000 people.
Ooh.
Yeah, and took donations and raised $5,000 that night for Music Cares, which is a great organization benefiting the gigging musician who pretty much now is out of work.
That is truly incredible that, well, one, that this organization exists. A lot of people would be so curious and would just love to be hearing about this kind of thing because it's such a, so many of us know someone who grew their hair and picked up a six string, including myself and you. But then looking at the fact that these folks, you know, we hear words like the gig economy and think, oh my gosh, all of my friends. In all honesty, Jim, most of my friends are artists or musicians these days or actors, theater geeks. Everything's come to a screeching halt. You mentioned one of the phrases that just really struck me, and that was, this is the sound of one hand clapping. And as you said, me too, it just gave me a chill. And then the following line is reflective. I think it's the following line. We used to hold hands, and now it's just so much different. So much came together for this song. Were you trying to pen a song when this all came together, or was this some meandering reflections that ended up taking form for the song once you knew that you pretty much had to put something together?
You know, David, it really came from whole cloth. I started with nothing. A lot of times you're right. A lot of times I'll take a piece of a song that I maybe couldn't finish a few years ago and I'll resurrect it. Maybe I've gained enough wisdom by then to actually, you know, finish it. But this song came all together in 6 hours. My favorite line, and thanks for mentioning that one line, we used to hold hands rocking and laughing, you know. But my favorite line is the last verse becomes hopeful. By the last verse, we're not looking down. We're looking, bring back the sound of music and laughter to this empty arena. And then I say my favorite line of the song is, hope is contagious more than any disease. And it's true. You know, you talk about the immune system and all the things you're supposed to do to keep it up and, you know, get plenty of sleep and eat healthy and all that good stuff. But, you know, frame of mind is so important to the immune system and your whole physical sense of well-being. You got to keep the hope alive. Hope is contagious more than any disease. That's the real stuff. You lose hope and you will go down. You've got to keep the glass half full.
That's right. Yes, absolutely. In addition to my producing and hosting this arts and entertainment related program on which this interview will be going, I'm also the local host for All Things Considered. So I'm both looking at arts and entertainment and escape, if you will, or a much needed positive look at other things. Then in the afternoons, I'm announcing everything about the coronavirus. And you know what? And I'm happy to be announcing these days about how many recoveries there have been as opposed to the numbers that keep on rising. So it's, yes, I'm very much a glass half full and looking for all kinds of hope. So this song, oh my God, Empty Arena, it's so timely and I appreciate this being put out so much. I was set to ask, that is, I'd love to be able to ask how audience were reacting to this, but we know that's in a way impossible. So I'm so happy you mentioned $5,000 raised just on that first broadcast or that first evening.
Correct. And it keeps rising. I haven't checked it today, but, you know, people want to get involved. And you can make a direct donation right to Grammy.com, Grammy.com/musiccares, one word, MUSICARES. You don't have to go through a middleman. You can make donations right to that. And by the way, if anybody wants to see a lyric video on this song, you go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/JimPeterickRocks. And that's one word, and Peterick is P-E-T-E-R-I-K. And my social media guru put together a wonderful, very touching series of photographs that you know, pretty much sum up what we're going through. And yet, at the end, the hope and the audience is that we'll someday again, very soon, be cheering again, together, holding hands, rocking. And you know what? When this all comes to an end, and it will come to an end, we are going to appreciate what we had 3 months ago more than we ever did before. We're going to be loving this.
That's right. That's right. This will come back around. Oh, my God. I'd almost like to just wrap right now and say thanks. That was, because that I can't really end on much more of a positive note than that. That is beautiful, Jim. It's, again, so appreciated.
Well, thank you. And Karen and I are big NPR fans, big All Things Considered fans.
Nice.
You know, honored to be on the other end of the phone here. And I love your slant on things. I mean, you watch the news and it's very slanted because I think negativity gets more viewers. It's
yes.
always the train wreck that gets more views than the victories. And I like that you're finding the recovery stories. I mean, you can't live in a glass house, but you can report the good stuff too.
That's right.
Listening to KVCR, it's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Many past KVCR's programs are at iTunes, NPR One, Spotify, and Google Play, and most past shows are kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Back now to Jim Peterick, formerly with Survivor. We'll hear about how Eye of the Tiger came to be, which came after a call from Sylvester Stallone, which Peterick thought was a prank. First, though, the Ides of March. If you don't know this tune, well, you'll definitely know the one up in just a bit. Let's switch over to the Ides of March. I have a few questions about this, but what I just read, this was formed when you were still in high school? How far in high school? Junior, senior, about to get out? Where were you in this?
Well, I was 14.
Oh my gosh.
I was a freshman in high school. Awkward, black rim glasses, shy, you know. We were all playing in the high school band. The original four Ides of March, Jim Peterick, that's me, Bob Berglund, bass, Larry Millis on guitar, Mike Borch on drums. We're all in the high school band. We're in the marching band. You know, it's so funny when you're a member of the band, you weren't necessarily looked up to by the sports people and the cheerleaders.
Yeah, that wasn't the cool time, yeah.
No, yeah, we were kind of the nerdy guys that played at halftime, but we loved playing rock and roll. And of course, one of our first rehearsals, we watched the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and that's such a pivotal moment in so many musicians' lives, where suddenly you go, okay, this is the goal here. Good looking guys dressed cool, girls are screaming, writing their own songs, singing. That's what we want.
Yep.
And you know, the Ides of March had our first hit record. And it was a minor hit, but a hit nonetheless on the Parrot label in the spring of 1966. It was called You Wouldn't Listen.
Yeah.
It went 7 in Chicago, 42 on Billboard. Dick Clark used it as a spotlight dance on the phone with Ron Riley, a local disc jockey here. And we were just starting out. We couldn't believe we had a hit record.
Inside my car, I got pictures, got candy, I'm a lovable man, and I can take you to the nearest star. I'm your vehicle, baby, I'll take you anywhere you want to go. I'm your vehicle, woman, by now I'm sure you know that I love you,
love you.
I need you,
need you.
I want you, got to have you tried. Great God in heaven, you know I.
And then we had many flops until 1970, when I wrote this song to try to win back my girlfriend, because she was asking me for rides everywhere.
Ah, beautiful.
And that even giving me a kiss on the cheek. And after about 3 weeks of being her limousine, I said to myself, all I am is your vehicle, baby. And I'm telling you, I heard this horn riff in the ether. Ba-da-ba-ba-da. And I just came up with this line, I'm the friendly stranger in the black sedan, would you hop inside my car? You know, it's just one of those things that it came magically, taught it to the band. Lo and behold, the song goes number two on Billboard, held off the one position only by No Sugar Tonight, American Woman. That's a sign of the times. But number one in the Cashbox magazine. And suddenly we're on the road. I mean, by this time I'm ripe old 19. And it was a great summer to have a hit record, I'm telling you. And a lot of pop festivals in that year. And we were opening up for Led Zeppelin, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, the Allman Brothers, Grateful Dead, wow. Coco, you name it. You name it. And we were doing Canada and America, living the dream at age 19. And those are great memories for me.
It just astounds me. I've interviewed many doo-wop era artists that got their start when they were just turning 13 or 14, male and female, and so, but it still always astounds me when someone has this kind of success and they're still, you know, their biggest concern should be maybe Claricel or something like that.
Good. I like it. Well, that's true. I mean, actually, we did a commercial for Tackle Pimple Cream back in 1966, and I'll never forget the announcer. You know, we do kind of a ripoff of You Wouldn't Listen, and we go, ding, 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 and the announcer goes, hey, fella, before you go out, and he's going, you got to look your best. You got to use Tackle Pimple Cream. Pimple Cream. Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
I know, that's the stuff you remember. I'm 69 now, and when I left Survivor in 96, I put back the Ides. I mean, we never stopped playing, but now we got really serious. And since 2000, we've been doing 50 shows a year and just having a blast. The original four guys, plus Scott, who's been with us for 31 years, and the best brass section we've ever had.
Yeah. I don't know how to ask this exactly, but back in the same late 60s, early 70s period, we had early Chicago, or CTA, and then Blood, Sweat, and Tears also. Ides of March, while having Vehicle hitting so high on the charts, did not see the same rise as the other bands with this horn-driven or backed or dominant sound. Is this because of maybe you guys took a break, I think, in 73 or so? I'm curious why the Ides of March even went on hiatus, unless this is drama, and I've never really tackled this in my shows.
No, I mean, that's a great question, really. Good question, because, you know, we had the sound.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, a lot of people thought we were Blood, Sweat, and Tears, because I was so influenced by David Clayton Thomas.
Yep.
You know, very well, you know,
exactly.
I was really challenging him, so that didn't work in our favor. And then the follow-up song was L.A. Goodbye, which was number one for 5 weeks in Chicago, but it never really spread to the degree we wanted to. And in 73, it was time to, you know, go on hiatus for a bit. In 77, I helped create the group Survivor.
Yep.
But I'll tell you, Ides of March was a family, and it still is. And cherish those days. And we're out there playing, well, until recently, 25 shows postponed to the fall and winter, and you were just knocking on wood that it all holds its course.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Jim Peterick, one of the founding members of the Ides of March, which we've just been hearing about. Up in just a bit, getting together with Sammy Hagar for Heavy Metal. First, though, yet another biggie. You mentioned Survivor, one of your biggest hits, and we have to get to Heavy Metal with Sammy Hagar in a second. But first, though, Eye of the Tiger. This was such a big one. And what I just read about 45 minutes ago is that you actually got a call directly from Sylvester Stallone, and you thought it was a prank. Can you please share with me that? I mean, even what you were doing. You were on Archie's chair, just relaxing in the recliner, you know, and then you get this call. Hey, Jim.
Well, you probably do a better Stallone than I do by the
sound
of that. Hey, you're good. Wow. Wow.
Theater
well,
geek.
I'll embarrass myself with my own imitation or impersonation, but I did get home from doing some shopping, and I walked inside my house in LaGrange where my wife and I lived. I had this big old answer machine, you know, and they are huge.
Yeah.
With a cassette inside. And believe me, I wish I still had this cassette. You never know you're making history until it's too late, you know. And I get this message. Hey, yo, Jim, that's a nice answering machine you got there. This is Sylvester Stallone. Give me a call. And I'm going, yeah, right, whatever, you know. And my wife goes, who is that? I said, some joker trying to imitate Stallone. She, in her wisdom, said, you better call him back just on the off chance that it's him. I said, he wouldn't be calling me without a secretary, you know. Well, called him back, and I very timidly say, this is Jim Peterick. Is this really Sylvester Stallone? He goes, hey, Jimbo, call me Sly. I mean, here's me from the small blue-collar town of Berwyn, Illinois, and I'm supposed to call my hero Sly. Right. Well, I got my nerve up, and I said, what's going on, Sly? And he says, well, I got this movie called Rocky III. I don't want to use that Gonna Fly now. It's a nice song, but I want something for the kids, something with a pulse, you know? Can you help me out? And I remember saying a really lame joke. I said, is the Pope Catholic? Yeah. And he was, like, laughing, you know, yeah, that's a good joke. Anyway, he said, I'm going to send you the movie, The Rough Cut, and I want you to write an anthem that will outlive you and me. Is that a problem? I go, no problem. Of course, I have a good bluff, but 2 days later, FedEx showed up at my door. I rented a Betamax Pro.
Ooh.
I invited Frankie Sullivan. Yeah, this thing was huge. It was like a microwave oven, you know.
Yeah.
And I put the cassette in, which was huge. You know, it's not a little cassette, a big, big cassette.
Yeah, right.
And all of a sudden, you see Mr. T, you know, rising up, and Stallone getting soft and kind of resting on his laurels doing Master Charge commercials.
Yeah.
You know, but what's weird is that there was music playing underneath the montage, and it was going, bump, 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 another one bites the dust. And I go, what the? I look at Frankie and go, he's got a song. So I call Sly. Hey, Sly. You got a song. What's going on? Another one bites the dust. Oh, yeah. Jimbo, can't use it. They wouldn't give me the publishing rights. To this day, I get down on my knees and I thank Queen for giving us a chance at the title, man. That's the best moment of my life.
That's incredible. I didn't expect anything like this. That,
you know, I have to admit, I accidentally had the Tanglewood concert with Terry Kath launching into 25 or 6 to 4 when I was first listening to Empty Arena. And so I heard this chicka, 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 chicka that was going on with it. And I thought, wow, this is nice, this sort of orchestral build with this chugga, 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 chugga. And it turns out, okay, that's Terry Kath. Different guitarist, different day.
Terry was a genius.
Oh, my God, yes.
Such a tragedy.
Yes.
He was the Chicago Hendrix, I'll tell you that.
Yep, he was Jimi Hendrix's favorite guitarist, as a matter of fact. Yes.
That is what I heard.
Yeah. So on Eye of the Tiger, did you develop that, I don't want to just brush it off as a riff, but you know what I'm saying there. There's that chugga-chugga, then the bump. Bum, bum, bum. Did that come together, or did you actually start doing the, you know, rising up straight from the top? Did you start writing out this driving sort of, I've got to go work out now kind of thing?
Yeah. I wish I had a dollar for every bead of sweat that people have raised.
Yeah.
And every muscle they made. But yeah, I mean, to answer your question, that was a big moment when I'm watching that action and I get my Les Paul on my neck. And I love that, what I call a dead string thing. I just started going digga, 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 yep. Digga, digga. I mean, it wasn't the first time that type of thing was used. I know Pink Floyd had a song like that with kind of that dead string thing. But then I'd see the punches being thrown, and I just started grabbing chords out of the air. Bump, 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 bump. Wait for the punch. Bump, bump, bump. It drives every drummer nuts because that one staggered beat, man. I was trying to coordinate the punch. And in the process, I separated the men from the boys in drummers. If they can get that hesitation, they're probably a pretty good drummer.
Yeah.
Rising up back on the street,
did my time, took my chances. I went the distance, now I'm back on my feet. Just a man and his will to survive. So many times, it happens too fast. You trade your passion for glory. Don't lose your grip on the dreams of the past. You must fight just to keep them alive. It's the eye of the tiger, it's the thrill of the fight, rising up.
I just, again, maybe right before we called, listened to the bluegrass interpretation of Eye of the Tiger that you released on a, I don't know if it was an EP or full album or what have you, but a thing called Songs, where you had, gosh, this, and also some of your 38 special works you had reimagined on this as well.
Reimagined's a great, great title for that. It really was reimagined with the help of Fred Mollen, a great producer who did all the Jimmy Webb albums through the years. And, you know, he came over from Nashville, and he picked up a banjo and starts plinking away. He says, we should make Eye of the Tiger like a bluegrass song. I go, you're crazy, you know? And he's going, I'm rising up, back on the street. In my time, took my chances. It worked, you know? And then we did High on You, like, as if Jimmy Buffett was going to do it. It was just, it was a hoot, I'll tell you, and I love that record. You're right, it's called The Songs.
Okay, so we could easily be going to Skynyrd from here, or we could go to 38 Special, where there's a Van Zandt connection there. And then your books, we will be touching on those in a near future interview, I really hope. But before we hang up in this last minute and a half or so, Sammy Hagar and Heavy Metal. Talk about an anthem. This one, I think Eye of the Tiger probably reached more people, but for my age and my level of geekdom, Heavy Metal coming out when I was maybe a sophomore in high school, somewhere in there. So yeah. This is, again, is it the riff or is it the words? What did Sammy do versus what did you do? You're both master guitar players and incredible vocalists and songsmiths. So who did what and how did this one come together, please? Heavy Metal.
Wow. Yeah. I remember he picked me up at the airport in San Francisco in his brand new red Ferrari Daytona. I was pretty impressed.
He'll do that.
I mean, to me, Sammy's like the persona of cool. Yeah. Cool rocker, rich, talented, good looking, an entrepreneur. I mean, he sold his tequila company for $80 million and he still owns part of it. Yeah. Come on. He's my hero. He's the American dream. And we got together, we went to his beautiful spread overlooking the redwood trees in Mill Valley. And he brewed some amazing coffee, which really got us stoked. He said, man, there's this new sci-fi animation coming out. My manager, Eddie Leffler, said, you guys got to write the theme song. I said, let's do it. And you know, we just started, well, the riff is all Sammy. You know, can't mistake it. And then he's jamming, and I start going, headbangers in the leather, box on in the dead of the night. And he goes, it all comes together when you shoot out the lights. And then I go, 50,000 watts of power and it's pushing overload. The beast is ready to devour all the metal it can hold, pushing overload. And then we worked like crazy on this chorus. It's your one-way ticket to midnight. Call it Heavy Metal, higher than high, feel just right. Call it Heavy Metal Noise. We recorded a demo of it on his multi-track cassette player. Eddie sent it to the movie company, and guess what? They loved it. suddenly we're in this great studio with the late Keith Olsen cutting the song, and just magic in it. Flash forward to last year, David, the Ides of March opened for Sammy in Cleveland. And in the green room, I said, well, we do heavy metal, but I said, Sammy, we won't be doing it tonight because you're doing it. He said, you're damn right you're doing it. I want to hear the Ides of March play that with the brass, you know. And so, okay, the middle of the set, you know, the place is packed. It was this arena that we played. And we go into heavy metal, and the brass is kicking, one way ticket to midnight, bad up, you know. Wow. And we look over, and there's Michael Anthony and Sammy on the side of the stage just rocking out. It was just a great moment.
Oh, beautiful. Jim, we're about a minute and a half past. I have to honor the other folks that you have ahead of you. But I will be contacting Bob straight away and getting something going where we can explore some of this stuff further and definitely talk about your books and just so much more. You know, we just barely scratched the surface. So, Jim, I greatly appreciate this extra time, and I look forward to the next one big time.
You too, David. Stay safe and keep rocking.
Definitely. Thank you so much. We will be talking to you really soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, brother. Thank you, man.
I've been speaking with Jim Peterick, formerly of Survivor and currently with the Ides of March and Jim Peterick's World Stage. More at jimpeterick.com. Also at youtube.com/JimPeterickRocks. Peterick is P-E-T-E-R-I-K. Look forward to more from Jim Peterick in the very near future. I certainly am. With that, we wrap up another edition of KPC Arts. Thanks again to Jim Peterick, as well as to Emmanuel Rogers, in conversation with John Goodwin of Galaxy Press. Here at KPCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and an extra thanks once again to Sharina Wad. Music beds and themes heard on KPC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.